your career as an entrepreneur is scalable, and the only way you're going to get there is by not being broke and getting traction.
Hey, podcast listener, even if you are alone in your entrepreneurial journey, know that today, right now in your earbuds, you are joined by thousands of entrepreneurs from all around the globe seeking to grow better, more profitable, location-independent businesses. If you'd like to learn more about what we do and download our entire back catalog, check out tropicalmba.com.
Welcome back to the podcast, Boss Man.
Yo.
Here we are. We're on video. You look 5 years younger. It looks like you went to a spa treatment.
There we go. I knew this was going to come up today. You trim a little facial hair. You grow a little facial hair.
Fresh as a baby.
It's the talk of the podcast. Can we move on?
Yes, we can move on. Stick around for today's show, everybody. We talk about the death of the follower, how I would make $250,000 in just 3 days a week if my business went away. We'll also talk about mistitling and what in the hell do visionaries do besides take naps and oversee the vision. All that and more on today's Tropical MBA podcast. I think there's an epidemic out there of mistitling. And I'm not just talking about chief happiness officers, Ian. I'm talking about calling your project manager a COO. I'm talking about calling your executive assistant a chief of staff. I'm talking about calling your uncle who does no code on the weekends your CTO. This is a problem. I'm talking about the person who posts on Instagram, your marketing director. Here's the thing. In the early days of a business, we've got loyal Swiss Army knives. We're flying around the office. We are a pirate ship. They do a great job. They hang around. You want to reward them with a title. It can be problematic. Jason Cohen, the founder of WP Engine, weighs in on this on Twitter. He says, early on, use titles that explain what the responsibility is, but without the formal titles. So he says, instead of calling someone a CMO, call them the head of marketing. Why is this a problem? Well, it can look dumb, right? Calling yourself the CEO when you have an agency of a couple freelancers in the Philippines and you're grinding out sales calls all day long. Might not look decent to your ICP. It confuses your team when you're benchmarking to the market. And if you are successful, you're ultimately going to float to the market and have to participate in it. So you want to ultimately benchmark to it. And you confuse your team members when you reward them with what are ultimately technical terms. So reward them in other ways. Reward them with a great title, a ton of responsibility, a great salary, but be careful about giving them technical titles and wait for that moment until you're actually going to the open market. You post a job that says CMO and a bunch of people with CMO experiences start applying. That's when you call it CMO. Until then, head of marketing should suffice. And until you have a board or a bunch of team members and you're not grinding out sales calls all day long, maybe call yourself founder instead of CEO. That's my hot take.
In terms of benchmarking, it's a way to float around different organizations and people know your area of expertise and your level of expertise as well. So if you want to start calling somebody in your company a CMO when you don't have any employees under them, you might have to actually pay for a CMO. And that's problematic because as a bootstrap company, you probably can't afford to do that. But I do think it's hard to figure out what to call each other sometimes.
Yeah, I'm going to start calling you Chief Substance Officer. That's a nice take.
Thank you. All right, Dan. So our buddy Nick Huber posted a tweet the other day that I found interesting because it's something that we talk about all the time. He basically says it's very hard to build a bootstrap business when you're broke. And I'm sitting here thinking like, most bootstrappers I know have started their business when they were broke. In fact, we were broke when we started our business. He goes on to say, you cannot operate at a high level unless you have consistent cash flow coming through the door to support your investments, hiring, and growth. Also, you're operating from a place of scarcity and fear. So basically, if you don't have enough savings or you aren't generating enough cash flow in the first 6 months of starting your new business, it might be time to find a job.
Well, first off, I am pro job. So I think it's always a good time to find a job. You know what is a great business? Having a job. You know why? You got one client to deal with. The retention level is relatively high. They pay on time. Cash flow cycles are fantastic. Your costs are low. And that's a great business right there.
Healthcare is often included.
I am pro job. Is it hard to start a bootstrap business when you're broke? No, you're right. Because most people start bootstrap businesses when they're broke. It can be harder when you have something to lose, right? Because now you're worried about paying the mortgage, about paying for all this stuff, and you start making silly decisions instead of doing what's best for the business. When you have nothing to support except for your idea, that can be a positive thing. On the other hand, what I love about what he's saying here is this concept of businesses that return the cash fast. In the milieu of businesses that you can start, very few will return the cash fast. When you look at the businesses most people love online, startups, software, technology, sending rockets to the moon, these businesses are enormously capital intensive. It's not a good idea to start these types of businesses if you are broke. Why not? And this is something I've seen Nick say many, many times. Focus on something that you can do that returns cash now. Build an agency, build a consultancy, build a service business. Start doing local services yourself. Get contractors to do it. Get the cash flow cooking. You'll build confidence. You'll build connections. And importantly, you'll build cash flow so you can build that dating app that you've been dreaming about building, which is going to take, let's face it, potentially years to get cash flow positive. Work backwards from your goal. If you're trying to increase your income, get the cash flow going. Guess what? There's a bunch of business models that can do that. In fact, we're going to cover some on today's show. And you know why a lot of people don't want to do those business models? Because they, quote, look like work. Honestly, that's the objection that I hear all the time. They're not scalable. But your career as an entrepreneur is scalable. And the only way you're going to get there is by not being broke and getting traction. This is what I love about the sweaty startup message. It's make money now, figure out what works now, and then progress into the bigger, more ambitious ideas.
One idea that we've talked about for over 15 years now is that it makes sense in these situations, and this is still true today, which is amazing to me. It makes sense if you are broke, like a lot of us were starting off, get yourself to a low-cost country where you can baseline. Basically, Latin America, you can be on the same time zone. Asia, you can live cheap and very well. Get yourself in one of these locations. Oftentimes, there's also a lot of other people that are in the same situation, so you have community. Get yourself in one of these situations where you can grow your business and not have to worry so much about your overhead.
I'm broke. I'm destitute. I've got no business ideas. I'm going on a 6-month vacation to Thailand.
That's right.
It's genius.
Live on someone else's it's sailboats. Genius. You know that most of the time they're not occupied, so you just go down to the dock.
Yes.
Make friends, get on the boat.
Yes.
It's not hard.
This is the way.
$500 later, you have some Starlink, you'll be good.
You know, I want to ask a very important question on today's podcast. It's simply this. What the hell does a visionary do? The vast majority of founders identify as visionaries, big picture, big idea types versus integrators, the bean counters, the authoritarians, the desk organizers. So let's start asking the question, like last episode, we talked about our concept of GPS, which is minimum viable integrator, right? It's goals, plans, scorecards. It's really simple. Minimum viable integrator. So now we got to ask ourselves, well, what are the visionaries doing with all their spare time? What is a visionary to do?
They're not willing to admit the answer to that, Dan, but I can give you some examples. Golf, smoking thin cigarettes, watching YouTube, professing to everybody that they're a visionary.
Lots of things visionaries can do, but I went to the source, Ian. I'm not satisfied with joking around about it. I went to the source, EOS Worldwide, Entrepreneurial Organizational System. I wanted to see what it is that the vast majority of us are to do on a day-to-day basis. And here it goes. overseeing the organization's vision.
Oh, yeah. Someone has to manage what I've created, even if it's only three sentences. Someone has to manage that.
That's right. Overseeing the organization's vision. And this is something that I think I've come to specialize in. You go to the team meetings and you say, look, you guys are going to do this, you're going to do that, and I'm going to oversee this vision. You know, I was a Boy Scout back in the day, an organization that has done a lot for me. And we used to play this campfire game where you would go and you would sing a rhyme about every profession you could become. So if it was like a firefighter, you'd be like, you know, you fight the fire, we do the dire, we blah, 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 blah. All I remember, it must have stuck with me. The only rhyme that I remember was the boss rhyme. And it went like this. I want to be a boss. You do this, you do that. Now I'll take a nap. That was the rhyme.
That's
okay. There's something to it. Okay. To EOS's credit, they say that visionaries, they close the big deals, they solve the company's biggest problems, they take occasional naps, they oversee the organization's vision. But it occurred to me last week, if you could select to have either an integrator or a visionary drive the company to eight figures, you would select the visionary. And the reason is sales and marketing. And so this is why we're sort of laying the groundwork of GPS, having a team that's on rails, that understands their goals, their plans, their scorecards. And then how does the visionary spend their day? Here's the thing. This visionary stuff can sound a little vague, but the best visionaries that I know actually have a bit of an integrator twinge to the way that they approach this visionary stuff. They have a structure, they have a system, and they have it scheduled. The best way you can be a visionary is you can schedule in, I know it sounds crazy, that creative, that growth, that ideas time. Here's a common way to do it, is that you don't do any managing in your business until 1:30 p.m. That's a common way that visionaries order their schedule. So they do GPS in the afternoons, and they do visionary stuff, does oversee, take naps in the morning. Now the key, can we get measurable, accountable, and aggressive in the mornings? This is what the best visionaries do. So what are we doing? Building for social media is something that I see great visionaries do, actually. That might be something like this podcast. This is being done in the morning right now. They might be hanging out on TikTok, Instagram, figuring out what the team looks like that's going to come in and put that thing on rails. They might be on sales calls. They might be building a cold outreach strategy. They are probably dipping into their key landing pages on a weekly basis and improving them and tweaking them based on the multiple handfuls of customer calls that they've done during their visionary time. So I think unless you're like a creator, a lot of visionaries, they're spending that time on the phone with clients. The same sort of obvious discipline that an integrator should have, managing people, holding people to KPIs, doing HR stuff, a visionary should have on the growth stuff. How many posts am I putting to social? How many phone calls am I doing during my visionary time? How many deals do I have in a pipeline? How am I recruiting a team around accelerating all of these key growth projects? And by the way, a little caveat there, recruiting is a big one that's like always there. The visionary is always, always, always recruiting. So there you go. There's just some ideas in between naps and overseeing your vision, which are undoubtedly important. I think putting on rails and making legible those growth tasks is the task of a visionary versus succumbing to the very obvious integrator type things that are everywhere all the time. That's why we're suggesting GPS for simplifying your integrator mind, your integrator function, and trying to get more disciplined about visionary stuff, which is the bet that you can grow the company. Ian, I want to talk about something called the death of the follower. And the reason I want to talk about it is I want to pitch you an idea of how I believe I could make $250,000 a year starting from scratch, working 3 to 4 days a week.
I'm in.
You're in?
Does it include running a go-kart track? Because that's my dream.
Ideally, yes. It would result in that. Yes.
Cool.
At least an annual GP as a branding exercise. Okay. So I came across this video on YouTube. It was a keynote at South by Southwest this year, which I don't go to. I go to YouTube instead. Jack Conte is the founder of Patreon. Patreon is a business that has 400 employees. It has over $100 million in estimated annual revenue. I couldn't find the exact number, but people are guessing. We're talking big numbers here. And what Patreon does is it helps creators charge membership fees to their followers. So Jack Conte, the CEO of this company, the visionary, goes up on stage and says, "This is the death of followers." And so I grab myself a Keurig coffee, single pot.
You're not supposed to admit to that these days, but okay.
I have no idea what the social implications of are using K-cups.
It's terrible.
I'll tell you what's not terrible is the K-cup situation for the individual themselves. So for living, I don't know if dolphins are eating it. I don't want you to tell me because I love these K-cups. You're going to have to tear them from my hand. Don't tread on my K-cups.
We'll just assume that they're recyclable type. Continue on.
If you send me a video of like some dolphin on a South American beach with my K-cup in their beak, then okay. Okay, so anyway, so I grab a coffee and watch this video. And I just want to say one interesting thing about Jack and how he built Patreon, because I actually used to watch Jack's videos back in the day when he was just a creator on YouTube, and he was an incredible creator. And I couldn't wait for his music. And he would do these really cool breakdowns of how he was making songs. And I write songs for fun and sometimes. And he's great at it. And he showed it on YouTube. He's one of the first people. And it was utterly fascinating. He ended up doing all this other really cool content on YouTube. His band and stuff. And super cool. But scratching his own itch with Patreon, basically saying, well, hey, now I've got, you know, 1,000 true fans. I got people that want to listen to my music. How do I make money from this? Patreon comes along and solves that problem.
And it started, this video is a good one. It's worth a watch. It started basically with him for years and years and years playing in bars and venues and not having a single person showing up.
Right.
And then basically putting his content out on YouTube, hearing about Kevin Kelly and 1,000 true fans, and then going from there.
And I want to get to that. That's a very important part of the story. So here's the story of the web that Jack tells. And he talks about the distress that creators are experiencing. In the 90s, we come up with these things called websites. If you remember, the primary way to connect with the creators of these websites was through portals, directories, and cross-linking. You would have like 20 websites in a bookmark, and you'd say, I'm really curious to see what if Ian posted today, because there's no push notifications. So I'm going to go check out Ian. He didn't post. And so I'm going to look at his sidebar. And there's 20 blogs that Ian reads. And I'm going to start to click out to those 20 blogs. I'm going to go to Yahoo, look at their portal. That's how the web worked. Then all of a sudden, Google comes along. And it's an algorithm that can take what you want to find, like Ian's blog, blogs like Ian's, and deliver to me more efficiently what I'm actually looking for. I might not actually be looking for exactly what you're posting. I want content like that. Google became basically the best business of all time by recognizing that fact and giving me what I want. Now, in the mid-10s, social media comes out. And Jack doesn't quite put it this way, but the way I see it is the process has repeated itself. Now, Ian starts a Facebook page or a Twitter account. And it's like, well, I want to know what Ian's going to post to the web. So now I'm following Ian again. And I check every day to see what you're posting. And people like Jack, a lot of the early Patreon stars and stuff, they built their audiences this way. When you would post something on the web, the people who followed you would see it.
Fast forward to today and the death of the follower. What's happened? The same thing that happened with the web.
Realize that, yeah, I follow Jack and I like his musical breakdowns, but I actually like all musical breakdowns, you know? And the algorithm is now picking this up where now every social platform is compelled, especially by the success of TikTok. TikTok started as interest, an algorithmic social network. What happened is the other social networks saw the success and stickiness of TikTok, and now they're all baking it back into their product. So if you were to log into your Twitter account 3 years ago versus your Twitter account today, they look worlds different. In fact, like I follow friends on X now who I never see their posts because X knows something that I know too, but didn't tell X. Think about how unsubtle the concept of a follow is that I follow them because they're my friend, but I don't actually engage with their content because they're in a different career field than me. And so I never really read their stuff, but it's nice to have on my follow list. So now you log on to X, and what I see is the posts that are going viral within my interests, within my friends, friends of friends, stuff like this. This is exactly what Google did to the web directories, right? Is now you're not going to 15 bookmarks every day. You started to have to play the algorithm. Jack talks about the anxiety that this creates for creators, which is the feeling that you've earned your followers and that now they're not going to see your content anymore. So what do you do? And I really walked away from this keynote thinking, what do you do? And then it occurred to me, we've been through this before. This is just SEO 2.0, replace search with social, right? And it actually could even be empowering to realize, like SEOs, the generation before, many of whom have become multi-millionaires with this one fundamental realization, which is building for the algorithm doesn't need to be that bad. And it doesn't need to be a destroyer of creativity. In fact, it can grow your creativity, which makes me cycle back to your original point, Ian. What did Jack's creativity look like when he was on tour with an acoustic guitar and a Casio piano in a dive bar? No audience. Why? It's a commodity. Everyone's over it. It's not that interesting to see a solo dude with a van and an acoustic guitar in some random coastal town in California. In fact, there's a bunch of people in that town itself who can do the same thing. It's not that creative. It's not that interesting. It's not something that only you can do as a creator. So Jack goes to the YouTube algorithm and he asks himself, how could I get a follower here? He says, well, what if I broke down using multiple shots of how I combine these instruments to make a song? That sounds a little bit more interesting than the next dude with an acoustic guitar while I'm trying to have a Miller Lite and watch the game. There's always been this element of the medium and the message. And that's fundamentally what creation and creativity is about. I think embracing that is a great strategy forward. What Jack outlines in his video, like you said, what's old is new again. At the end of the day, we're back to Kevin Kelly. If we can't depend on the fact that we're going to build these big reach audiences and our followers are our followers, and we're going to quote, own them, own their attention, then relying on business models like advertising, like low Patreon tiers, is probably not the best way to proceed. He advises higher friction business models, high tier memberships, ministering to the 5% of engagements that really, really care about your message. We see a lot of cohort-based learning now, events. So when you talk about ticket sales to an acoustic gig, you talk about advertising, you talk about t-shirts and merch, you're talking about business models that depend on a huge reach. And what Patreon's building for, what Jack's advising, is that you focus on business models that minister to those true fans. To quote Kevin Kelly, the Oracle, kk.org, he writes in his now canonical article, 1,000 True Fans, To be a successful creator, you don't need millions. You don't need millions of dollars or millions of customers, millions of clients or millions of fans to make a living as a craftsperson, photographer, musician, designer, author, animator, app maker, entrepreneur, or inventor. You only need 1,000 true fans. A true fan is defined as a fan that will buy anything you produce. It's just not t-shirts anymore. It's not the $15 cover charge to a dive bar. It's going to be stuff that's up the value chain. So it looks like an opportunity to me. And I wanted to point this out because it's a conversation we've had over the years here. 1,000 true fans is now canonical. But what do we talk about? 100 true customers. 100 true customers pay you $500, $1,000 a year. We talk about 10 true clients. 10 true clients pay you $10,000 a year. And a concept I wrote down is 5 true partners. 5 true partners could pay you $4,000 a month. And that could be $250,000 in gross receipts for you in a year. How could you produce this, understanding the concept of the death of the follower? One thing I want to note about these algorithms is that wealthy people are less likely to engage. Classic social media engagement.
And why is that?
Because they don't want to leave a trail. They have more to lose. So if you notice, one of the problems with Reddit as a company and as a brand is that they're not able to monetize their users as much as other platforms. And I think there's a variety of reasons for that. But Reddit, on the social sort of schema, is people talking with less to lose. And if you think about people that become more wealthy, they start to lean a little bit more conservative because they want to preserve wealth, preserve reputation. They're less likely to tee off on the web. They're even less likely to follow accounts and like things. And I'm not saying this is universal, but it's something to consider that people clicking the like button isn't necessarily always what you want to optimize for. You might want to optimize for that true fan who's, guess what, not going to click like, but they're going to read it. They're going to read it and they're going to be interested. So I think this idea of finding 4 or 5 clients that are paying you between, say, $3,000 and $6,000 a month is super doable. Here's how you could do it. You learn the algo of the social platform that you love, whether it's TikTok, whether it's Instagram, whether it's X. Where does your target market hang out? Does it fit your creator pattern? Can you create for it and be competitive there? Do you love Instagram? Could you put up detailed PowerPoints on Instagram that outline interesting strategies for your expertise? That kind of content's super interesting when it's other people just posting about their dog or whatever. It's like, oh, wow, here's like a 10-slide deck that's like outlining this interesting principle that a client made X number of money, or that this person increased their vertical leap by this or whatever. That kind of stuff can be really interesting. Learn that stuff. Be yourself on the platform. Go deep. Paint yourself as a hero on the journey. Take calls. Take calls from people that don't want to click like, but they want to schedule a call. All you need is one prep day a week for your 5 clients, one delivery day a week, and 1 hour a day on social. So that's the roadmap to $250,000 in revenue. And you can get an executive assistant to help you with all this using the 1,000 True Fans business model and the concept of social media right now. You choose one platform. You spend an hour a day on it, one day in client calls, one day in prep. I believe that would be a roadmap to make $250,000 a year. It's not just belief, because I know people that are doing it, but I can't say their names. But it's totally doable.
You also know people that have 250,000 followers on Instagram and aren't making a dollar off it.
There you go.
So there's a bunch of non-obvious things about this. One of the things that I'd like to point out too with 1,000 true fans is if you have 1,000 followers on Instagram or Twitter, those aren't true fans. You have to figure out like how large the top of the funnel needs to be to actually get to the 1,000 true fans.
100%.
So there might be some kind of calculation here. I haven't seen it or done it myself, but how many followers do you have to have on Twitter to make the true fans true?
Well, here's what I would say. This is why I'm taking what Jack is saying. Shout out, Jack. You're an amazing drummer. Forget about 1,000 true fans. Let's talk about 5 true partners. Let's talk about 10 true clients.
let's talk about 100 true customers. The people that I see that are having success with these very simple business models, they're doing it with a high price point. They're doing it with limited audiences. They're doing it very specific about who their ideal client profile is. It's either an hour a day on social, it's a few conferences here and there, it's DMs, it's networking. It's totally doable with a very, very small audience. It's about getting yourself into the right rooms, both in terms of conferences and networking, and the right rooms on social, positioning yourself and being serious about, hey, I'm not putting out a post that's going to get virality. The value of the death of the follower is this: understanding the algorithm doesn't mean go viral. The algorithm will now deliver this very niche content to you if people in your network already like it. So if someone comes out with banger of a post that like 15 people like, that goes in depth about specific financial topic or something very specific and high level, that could be surfaced to your ICPs now. And that is the creativity, the moment in time we find ourselves in, is you just need to get a few of these people that follow you that they're influential in and amongst themselves. You're the person behind the person. And now all of a sudden your posts that have 100 views are being surfaced to relevant people that are making buying decisions. And that's the opportunity we find ourselves in, where you just, it's not about just going out there and being famous. Because remember, Jack's original lament was, I was famous in terms of follower count, but now I'm not famous to the algorithm. Well, the algorithm is not only a shotgun, it's a sniper rifle. And that can be the opportunity of learning how these things work, is making very, very specific stuff. Forget about your 1,000 true fans, go find your 10 true clients. So that's honestly, even if you were like, no more business, no more podcast, how would you go out and make a living? This is exactly what I would do tomorrow. I would spend 1 hour a day on a social channel. Probably for me, I'd choose either Instagram or X. I'd hang out there for a day. I'd learn the algorithm. I'd focus specifically on high value content for my ICPs. I'd start taking calls. I'd build up a roster of really great clients, because I'd have a waiting list, because I've got really focused content. I solve a really focused problem. I'm taking calls. I spend 1 day on delivery with my clients. I do calls, 5 calls, 4 calls that day. And the day previous, I prepare for those calls. The rest of the 3 days of the week, you know what I'm doing, Ian?
Golf.
Oh, sorry.
While on the golf course, I'm overseeing the vision. Yes, that's exactly what I'm doing. That's it, Ian. It's time for me to do visionary things, because I identify as a visionary. I'm going to go to the golf course. I'm going to oversee the vision, and you maybe cut a deal. I'll cut a deal here or there.
That's great, man. You're a valued member of this team. We all know that I'm the integrator, and I'll be at my desk for the next 12 hours. So you enjoy your day, and we'll figure out a way to make it valuable, I'm sure.
Call me.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Tropical MBA podcast. You can go to tropicalmba.com, get access to hundreds of back episodes and all kinds of other goodies. Load up your iPod. That is the cheapest way to fly business class on your next international flight. We will see you next Thursday morning, 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.